Thank you, ladies. We had all short ladies to read today, didn't we? It is a great honor for me to be able to introduce this lady this morning. I've known her for quite a long time. I've been in this program since August the 4th of 1978, and I've heard a lot of speakers, been around a lot of them, but I've never been around one that's in the program more than this lady. She has a sponsor. She sponsors people. And she does workshops. She really works this program. She loves Al-Anon and AA. And I want y'all to help me give Jan H. from Fredericksburg, Texas, a warm welcome.
Whew. Who'd have ever thought somebody like me would end up in a place like this? I am Jan Holly, and I am from Fredericksburg, Texas, Michaela. And Texas is so good. You know, if you just knew how good Texas were, you'd all just move out there. I'm here today to try to share my spirit, strength, and hope with you. And first, I want to thank Glenda for that really wonderful introduction. Not sure about all that, but I could have just, that page that was read, you could have taken that first half of that page and read it, and I could have sat down. I mean, that was pretty much my story. But the committee's been so wonderful. I want to thank Jay and Glenda for inviting me out here. It's always an honor to be asked to speak anywhere and to share. And I want to especially thank a little lady named Joyce that met me at the bathroom door, and she was there just when I needed her this morning, and she gave me that hug and that encouragement that I needed, and thank you. I'm going to try to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I can tell you what I was like in just a few short sentences. What I was like was a desperate woman on a relentless search for unconditional love. The problem was I looked for it in all the wrong places. And the more I didn't find it, the more unlovely I became and I felt. I really believe from the time I was a little bitty girl, the only thing that I lacked in qualifying for Al-Anon was an alcoholic. And I set out to find one as soon as I could. And that brings me to him. My husband, Ray, would you wave so people know who you are? I didn't say, oh my God. As you can see, he likes to take all the credit, actually. He did give me a lot of material, and he still does. Ray and I have been married a little over 49 years, and it's only through the miracle of AA and Al-Anon that we're anywhere together today. He tells me that I can say anything at all about him, even if only part of it was true, but then how would he know? But we don't have secrets anymore. I guess I'll start at the beginning. I was born the first of two children in Monroe, Louisiana, to a young couple who were very poor at the time. I didn't realize that, but they worked very hard, and before long they acquired a little corner neighborhood grocery store. And 9 years later, my little brother was born. Now, my parents were what I would say they were a normal family. There was never any drinking in our family. But I had this grandmother and grandfather that lived with us part of the time and helped us to run the grocery store. Now, this grandfather, though, he would keep a bottle hid out in the flower bed, and he'd sneak out there and take a little dip every so often. And I don't think he was an alcoholic, but I think he just liked to aggravate my grandmother. She was a very strict, very straight-line Baptist woman, and very unemotional. And she raised my mother, and my mother, when she was a little girl, she was tied in a chair while my grandmother would work in the fields. My dad's mother died when he was 6 years old, and he was raised truly by the proverbial stepmother. So my parents gave me love in the only way that they knew how. They gave me a lot of things. They gave me all the things they didn't have. But I don't ever remember having hugs or kisses or I love yous. But somehow I felt that they did. I was pretty spoiled. When I was about 16, my daddy bought me a brand new red Impala. It was at the time, I can't remember, 58 or 59, tell my age here. But I was one of the very few people at school that had a brand new car to drive to school, so I was pretty spoiled. But most of my life, I remember feeling empty, insecure, lonely, and afraid. I felt like that other people had secrets to life that I didn't know and somebody wasn't telling me. But I put on a good front, I put on a good face. In fact, I found out years later that a lot of people thought I was stuck up, but it wasn't that. I was just so afraid, so insecure, and felt less than. When I got into the program, I would hear the alcoholics talk about that old hole in their soul with a cold wind blowing through, and then I knew that's what I felt. That's what I always felt most of my life. And looking back at high school, I was very popular, although I didn't think so. I was a majorette, made very good grades. I had a lot of friends and a lot of dates. But there was never enough. There was just never enough. I always had to have something outside of me to be okay. You know, a new dress, a new car, the right boyfriend, a mind-altering man, preferably. Back in the late 50s, there was this drive-in restaurant called the Hollywood, and all the kids in high school and college would drive round and round, and the idea was to try to get a parking place on the lot and to sit there and drink beer and eat pizza and just see who was there to be seen. And so one night I was there with a date on the parking lot in his brand new, I think it was a DeSoto. It was one of those that had the big fins. It was just a beautiful, beautiful car. And Ray walked over to the car, and he was a friend of my date's, and he sat down in the back seat of the car, and which was what we normally did, to talk. And but Ray was very drunk, and he was real upset about breaking up with a girlfriend, and so, of course, I tried to tell him all the ways he could get her back. And but the evening ended up with Ray throwing up all over the back seat of my boyfriend's new car. Now, when Ray tells his story, he says, "For me, it was love at first sight, but y'all know better than that." But I did meet him again some months later, and I don't have a memory of it being the same person. I probably wouldn't have dated him, but, you know, who knows? He was one of those mind-altering men, you know. But he had, he was so good-looking. He had big muscles, and as my grandson said yesterday, he said the operative word is had. Leave it to a kid, you know. He had those big muscles and bronze tan, and those muscles just filled out this black knit shirt so beautifully. And he was in college, and he had a 57 T-Bird convertible. And he smoked. Oh, yeah. He was just the thing for me. We dated for about a year and a half, because when I met him, I was about 16, and he was 20. But we dated about a year and a half and got married just as soon as I graduated from high school. My daddy tried everything in the world to talk me out of it. He said, "Oh, you know, you've got a scholarship as a majorette to Ole Miss. You can do that. I'll buy you a convertible. Do anything." But nothing would work. Nothing could talk me out of this. This was the person that was going to fill that old hole in my soul. This was the person that was going to make me okay. He was the man of my dreams, my knight in shining armor, and I was going to be okay, and he was going to make me happy. So we set out on that dream of happiness and of having a beautiful home and a family. And, of course, we were going to wait for our family for a while, but it didn't last too long. But the first year I started seeing a little temper in Ray. He would lose his temper real easily, and I'd never seen that when we were dating for some reason. Now, my parents never lost their temper, and I don't remember ever having a crossroad word with each other, but so it really bothered me, and it really scared me, and I didn't know what to do. But I was raised, you know, that I had married this man, and I was going to make him happy if it killed me, and of course, it almost did. But within, about a year, he was in college when we got married, and I was working, but then, as he said, I got myself pregnant, and he had to quit school and go to work. And he went to work for a discount store, one of the very first ones years ago. And within a year, he was transferred to Natchez, Mississippi, and he opened a discount store over there as a manager. And pretty soon, I had our second little boy. They were only 16 months apart, and I didn't know what to do with these kids. I'd never been around little kids. I never babysat. I never kept children, and I was away from my mother, and I couldn't even boil an egg. I knew nothing about keeping a house or children. But Ray worked all the time, and I stayed home and kept the kids. And he would come home more and more restless, irritable, and discontent. Now, there was no drinking. I was told that he drank a lot, of course, before we met, really, but very little while we were dating, and almost none through the first many years of our marriage. But yet he had all of those symptoms of the alcoholic that I know now, I didn't know then. And as he would be more restless and irritable, I would get more nervous and insecure because I thought it was about me. You know, if I was pretty enough or sexy enough or smart enough, then he'd be happy, but it never worked that way. I was real hard on the kids. I really bordered on abusive to my children, and that is the one thing that I am the most sorry for. If I could change it, that's one thing I would change, but even God can't change the past, and I know that now. In about 8 years, he was transferred back to the home office and as an officer, and before just probably 3 or 4 years, he moved right up to the top, and he still worked all the time, and I stayed home and kept the boys, and you know, I developed a lot of obsessions. I would clean. Oh, I was a clean freak, and I would cook great meals and try to keep the boys quiet, anything to make this man happy. And the more I tried, the more it didn't work. Because, you see, if he was happy, then we'd all be happy. And then I would wait every night to see what kind of mood he was going to be in before we knew how we were going to act. And we never knew. And it could change in like lightning speed, so we never knew. And I taught my boys to walk on eggshells. We kept a lot of secrets from him so we wouldn't upset Daddy. And I thought I was protecting them from him, but really I was probably harder on them than he would have been. And I drove a big wedge between them and their dad and their relationship that has been really hard to repair. Our oldest son was very talented and into everything and excelled, and we pushed him hard, and he did. He obtained a lot of things. He was an airplane pilot at 16 and a ham radio operator at 12, and he played guitar, and he was a football star and a basketball star, did all these things. But then he'd get tired of them, and he'd get in trouble, and he'd drink or whatever, and it seemed like we were always just fighting fires that this son was starting. And our younger son, he just kind of stood back, and so he got ignored a lot, and he just watched his brother. He was only 1 year behind his brother in school, so he grew up in the shadow of this talented, gregarious young man. And I don't mean to say that all the times were bad at home. They weren't. We did a lot of camping and fishing and hiking and vacations and ball playing. We had a good time. But always, you never knew that time when it was all going to break loose. And we never knew why. It was very scary. And the more I retreated into myself as a person, there was nothing really left in me but a shell. I was emotionally and spiritually bankrupt. But our sons finally left home, and life got a little better with teenagers out of the house. Because Ray worked all the time, and then I could play. And I did, and I bowled, and I played cards, and I shopped. Of course, I loved to shop. But, you know, he made a lot of money, and it was my job to spend it. And I did a real good job of that. Because, see, I thought if I could find the right outfit, I was always looking for that right outfit to make me look so good that he couldn't resist me. Because, I thought it was all about me. And there was still no drinking. But there was still that temper. And I've come to realize that Ray never hit me, but really, emotional and verbal abuse can leave longer-lasting scars than physical abuse. Emotional abuse can bruise the soul. Sometimes that takes a long time to heal. A few years, Ray called me and said, I'm coming home, I'm retiring. Something had happened at his company, and for ethical reasons, he could not work there anymore. He was only 42 years old, and he came home, and after the shock wore off, things got really good. They got real good. We started drinking. And we would go on cruises and we'd drink. And we had 2 recreation homes and we'd go to one of them and we'd ski or we'd fish and we'd drink beer. And, you know, we'd have people over for parties and then we'd drink. And it was really good. In the evening we'd have hors d'oeuvres and he'd have his brandy and I'd have my white wine. and life was good. The alcohol was working. It was his solution. And so it was my solution. After about 3 years of this retirement, the company was bought out with a leveraged buyout, and then the company that bought them went into bankruptcy and said they were not going to pay his retirement anymore. We had to go to a bankruptcy court and sue for a partial settlement, but this caused us to have to look at something. At only 45 years old, we thought we might have to do something else to earn a little money, and went into real estate. Now, I had always been a stay-at-home mom, and he was a businessman and had run a large company of over 100 stores. And so he was the broker of the business, and I was a salesperson. We built a big office building and hired agents, and we were doing really well. And little by little, I would notice that Ray started going home earlier, and he would start drinking without me. And I'd get real resentful and aggravated. I'd have to stay maybe and work with the client or close the office or whatever, and he would be home drinking. He might be passed out on the bed, and most of the time I'd hurry home, try to get some food in him before he'd pass out, and this started to cause a lot of problems. He didn't want to eat, he wanted to drink. I can't even tell you when, I laughed, I said if I'd known I was going to be doing this one day, I would have took notes, but I don't know when this all started, but back there sometime. Anyway, one night I was walking by his chair. He was always in that recliner with his brandy and kicked back and watching TV. And I was bustling around trying to get food ready. And he turned and he looked at me. And all I can say is evil looked out of those eyes. And he said some horrible, horrible things to me. He threatened me, threatened to kill me. And he'd never been like that. And I didn't know anything to do but just run. And I ran, and I ran out of the house. We had a big, big yard, several acres, and we had these big pine trees, and I hid behind the pine trees and watched to be sure he wasn't coming after me, and that time he didn't, but, I thought about calling the police, but he always was armed, and he would never have been taken alive, that's for sure, and I'd sneak back up and peep in the windows and see what he was doing. He was always real hyper, and he was pacing and talking to people on the telephone, and but I was too afraid to go back in, and I watched till he went back in another part of the house, and then I snuck in and grabbed my purse with car keys and ran, and I went to a hotel, and that was my first of many nights staying in a hotel. It was one of the worst nights of my life until that time, and I didn't know what to do. There was nobody I could tell. I was so prideful because people like us don't live like that. But I came back the next morning. I got up and went to the store and bought a new outfit and makeup and everything, got ready to go to work, and slipped back out to the house to peep and be sure he was alive, and obviously he was. And so I went to work, and this started a series of these things happening, but I never knew when they were going to happen. You just never could tell. But I finally got smart, and I hid a little getaway bag outside in a storage room, one that had, makeup, a nightgown, change of clothes, whatever, and toothbrush. And because, see, sometimes I had to climb out windows. Yeah, I'd climb out windows, and he'd chase me, and we'd run, and I'd hide, and he'd chase me. And I can't imagine living like that now, but I did. And I'd always come back. I'd always come back. And that's the crazy thing. And when I first got into the program, my sponsor had me to read the big book first thing, and she and I found this chapter called There's a Solution, and in it talks about the alcoholic at times being unable to bring to their consciousness with sufficient force the humiliation of even a week or a month ago. And that was me, and I did it start raving sober, but I always came back, and I thought it would never happen again. And I always blamed it on anything but the alcohol. It was always something else. But I finally got smart. I had an idea. I heard this a couple weeks ago at a meeting. Somebody said, an idea to an untreated Al-Anon is as dangerous as a drink is to an alcoholic. And I believe it. But this was going to be a scientific experiment, you see, because I was real good in chemistry and math and all of that, so I was going to do this experiment. So I took this invisible tape and I put it on the liquor line of the bottle, because I'd already tried the pouring out stuff, and he'd just buy more. But I'd put it on the liquor line of the bottle, and then I would measure to see how much he drank and if he went into a blackout or if he didn't. Never worked. Sometimes he'd drink just a little bit, he'd go in a blackout, and sometimes he'd drink a lot and he wouldn't go in a blackout. So I had to scrap that plan. And sometimes he would get in the car and go to the camp and totally in a blackout. And I'd follow him up there, and I'd peep in windows, and I'd hide behind trees. You know, works at the camp just like it worked at home. And be sure he didn't kill himself. That was my big deal, want to be sure he didn't kill himself. And, of course, he never did. And finally, though, I've got to tell you about this one. This was one you're going to love. I came home one morning after the blackout deal, and there were bullet holes in the refrigerator. Now, I tell you what, that refrigerator was running at least 10 years after that. And I wish I had wrote down the name and I'd tell you, because that refrigerator was bulletproof. So you know those magnets that you put on the refrigerator, you know? But, see, this ideas I always have, I didn't just put them on there, somebody might move them. I glued them, I super glued those magnets to the bullet holes. So nobody would know. People like us don't live like that. You know, and every time I'd get up and I'd go to work and act like nothing had happened, and there was nobody I could tell. And looking back, I had friends, I had family. I didn't have to stay in motels, but if I had gone to stay with them, I would have had to tell, and I couldn't tell. I was too prideful. I could not admit that I was that kind of person, that I would live like that. But finally, I came to my senses. It was the alcohol, for God's sake. It was the brandy. So I decided he could switch from brandy to Jack Daniel's Black Label and it'd be okay. And he liked it, and it worked for a while. In fact, we used to go up to visit one of our sons that lived in New England at the time, and my daughter-in-law would always have his Christian Brothers brandy ready for him. And I called her before we were going. I said, no, he can have whiskey, but no brandy. And everybody went for that. Raven went for it. He thought it was okay. And but, you know, once in a while I'd say, well, you know, we need to quit drinking. And he'd say, okay. We'd go 3 or 4 days, and he'd, you know, we'd prove that we could not drink, and he'd come home with my wine and his brandy, and he'd start again. But finally, a miracle happened in our lives, and I think it might have been the window of opportunity that God gave us. And during this time, I didn't give God a lot of thought in my life. I'd been to church on and off, but, you know, I was either above these people, they were hypocrites, or either I was below them. And if they knew what I was really like, and if they knew I drank alcohol, they'd probably kick me out. So most of the time, I didn't go. But this particular night, I had come home and I was bustling around as usual, doing the same insane stuff and fixing food. And he was drinking his—I don't know if he was on brandy then or I don't remember anyway, some of that stuff. And he was drinking it anyway, and he kind of lost his temper, but it seemed like he wasn't quite as bad as he had been usually. So I just took the dog. We always had Airedale dogs, and I took the dog and just huffed out of the house and took the dog, started walking down the road. But when I got back, I saw flames coming out of the kitchen window, and something in me changed at that time, and I snapped, and I was through. I was my bottom span. As far as I was concerned, it was over. You know, I remember thinking many times, one of these days he's going to kill me, and still I would stay. But this time I didn't even care. It didn't matter anymore. I was through. And so the other miracle is that he just started crying. And he said he was going to go to the camp and kill himself. And so I said, let me drive you. So we got him and the dog in the car, and we started out. We had this long driveway, and when I got to the end of the driveway, instead of turning left, which would have taken us to our camp, which was about 25 miles away, I turned right. I don't know why. It was just God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, and I had no idea where I was going or what I was doing. But I drove to a hospital that was several miles away, and it treated mental illness and addiction. And I drove there without ever knowing that hospital was there. But God took me to that hospital, and I left him there. And thank God it was a lockup hospital. He was locked down with guards at the door. And that was another miracle. And I went home that night, and I don't even remember having much feeling that night. I was just still in a kind of a trance. And I cleaned and I cleaned and I cleaned and I cleaned. And, you know, there were peas on the floor, peas on the ceiling. Have y'all ever had seen those little blown ceilings have little knobs on them, try to get the peas out? Well, it ain't easy. But I went to bed and got up the next morning, got dressed, put on my makeup, went to work like nothing had happened. And I didn't know what in the heck I was going to do. I didn't know how to run a business. I had no idea. And there was nobody I could tell. So I made up a big lie, and I told him that Ray had been called out of town to help one of our sons with a business deal, and he'd probably be gone about 30 days. So I had no idea how to run a business or what to do, but I did have a broker's license, and I did learn to run a business. I did learn to manage people. And I bought a little button at Ruston one year, and it said, every problem contains a gift. And the gift that came out of that was, some years later, I was chosen Businesswoman of the Year for the state of Louisiana. That don't happen for insecure women like me. There was about 10 days before I could see him. That was the policy of the hospital. And so I remember that Sunday afternoon I was going to go see him, and it was over as far as I was concerned. And I knew when this important man found out where he was and I'd put him there, it was going to be over for him too. So I walked in there, and he was in a big cafeteria, almost big as this room, and I could see him across the floor at the table, and he stood up and he put his arms out, and a different man looked out of those eyes. And he's been a different man to this day, and a miracle had happened in that treatment center. And I won't go into that. That's his miracle, and that's part of his story. I stayed that day for my first AA meeting, and I was amazed. I had never been in a place and seen grown men cry and talk about God and talk about their feelings like that. I was just bowled over. I didn't realize it, but an outside group was bringing, I knew nothing about AA, an outside group was bringing a meeting in, and when they, everybody was introducing themselves, and when they got to Ray, he said, "Hello, my name is Ray, and I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "No, you're not." I didn't want him to be an alcoholic, for God's sakes. I mean, I'd just rather him be crazy. You know, alcoholics sleep under the bridge, and, you know, and they just bum around. They got a wine bottle in their back pocket, and, you know, they drink all day long. Ray never drank in the morning. He never drank until time for a gentleman to drink, and he never drank all day, and some days he didn't drink at all. How could he be an alcoholic? But, you know, I remember back years before when we'd have a big fight and I'd really want to hurt him. I would tell him he was crazy like his mother. And I have a lot of regret for that, and I made amends for that. His mother died at 51 of this disease. And just a few short years later, his two little half-brothers also died of this disease. And, you know, we used to look down on them, that they couldn't manage their lives, not knowing that a few years later we would be walking in those shoes. You know, I was so prideful, so judgmental, until alcoholism nearly destroyed my life. Another little miracle while he was in that treatment center. When he had sobered up for about 3 days, I found out that he had told them that he wanted to get out. That he knew the law was that you couldn't keep anybody against their will for more than 3 days, and so he wanted out. And they said, "Well, you signed that, your rights away." He said, "Well, if I did, I was drunk, so it's not a valid contract." "And I'm going to call my lawyer." They said, "Well, I can call your lawyer in 30 days. And you know what a miracle that was. I mean, that hospital was taking a chance. They really were. And that was a miracle. Another little funny thing is he called me one day, and he was just dying laughing, just so tickled. And I said, what in the world? And you know those little pointer signs that realtors have that, you know, they're on a corner, and they point down a road, and it says for sale, home for sale, or whatever, and usually have the company's name? Well, in the driveway of this treatment center, it was a long drive back to it, in the driveway right in the middle of this treatment center was a sign that said, for sale, Holly Realty. Somebody knew. I was so mortified. He thought it was funny. The doctors thought it was the funniest thing in the world, and I didn't think it was funny. Because I still hadn't told a soul, not my parents, not my children, nobody had I told. Now, during the time he was in the treatment center, another little thing came up. Is our youngest son was going to get married, and he had moved to Charleston, South Carolina, and he'd met a girl. He was going to marry her. And all the guys were going to be in the wedding. We had their tuxes all picked out, everything going, and Ray was supposed to be in the wedding. And I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do? So at family week, I talked to his doctor, and he was doing good enough by that time with his steps. And he said, okay, he would let him go as long as he could see the ticket and know when we were going to leave and when we were going to come back and have no spare time in there. And so we went, and when we were there, our oldest son and his wife were there, and she had our first grandson in her belly. And we told both of them about it, and because her mother was a recovering alcoholic, and we told them about the family disease of alcoholism. And that first grandson of ours just went to the University of Alabama this year, and I'm so thankful he never had to see his papa drunk or his nana too crazy. When Ray got out of that treatment center, I thought, this is it. This is the man. This is the one I wanted all this time. He was going to make me happy. They fixed him. I'm going to be happy. Nada. He traded his obsession for alcohol for an obsession for AA. He'd go to 3 meetings a day, and when he wanted a meeting, he was at a coffee shop talking about a meeting. I was told early when he was at the treatment center, I need to try Al-Anon, and I did try it, and I just found a lot of gripe in there. At least that's what I was hearing in this particular group, and so I thought, this is not for me. And I have learned one thing, that all the groups are not alike, and if I can't find one that I fit in that's healthy, that I find another one, or I'll get me a coffee pot and go start one. But I didn't go back. I went to probably 6 or 8 meetings, and I couldn't go. But it's his problem. I mean, all I wanted to do is make him happy, and so it was his problem, and he was fixing it. But as the months went by, well, I got more and more resentful and more jealous. You know, he was growing spiritually, and he was definitely not that mind-altering man anymore, and I was still sick, so sick. I would go to AA meetings with him a lot of times, and I would just, you know, give him a little nudge in the ribs when he something he needed to hear. But mostly I went to watch you AA hussies. Y'all know how y'all are. Always hugging and all that stuff. Well, I guess it was probably a little over a year went by, and our marriage was in trouble. I mean, it was going right down the drain. He was doing good, and I was a wreck. I was a mess, because no longer could I blame everything wrong on him anymore. And we were just doing really bad, and I don't think we would have stayed together and made it, even after all of those years and all I went through. I don't think we could have made it through sobriety had I not gotten into Al-Anon. But another miracle happened, and I went to his group's anniversary one Sunday afternoon. And there was a couple speaking there, and the woman was an Al-Anon, and she was a beautiful little blue-eyed, white-haired, angelic-looking woman. And she told her story, and I wanted what she had. And, of course, she zeroed in on me when she found out I wasn't an Al-Anon and invited me to her meeting, and I went that very next day, and that was January 23rd, 1992. And from the day I started, I went to at least 3 meetings a week, and the only thing I really remember about my first couple of meetings was that my sponsor, Aline, said, once you walk through the door of Al-Anon, you never have to be alone anymore. And I try to remember to say that, because I was so alone, so alone. There was nobody I could tell. And yet here was this group that I could tell. And the other thing was there were so many women there, and that was one of my biggest hurdles. I never liked women. You know, they were backbiting and catty, and you couldn't trust them, and they were always after you, man. You know how that is. But, you know, I learned to listen and start looking at their insides rather than their outsides, and they were just like me. They wanted a happy life. They wanted a happy family. That's all they wanted. But I went about 9 months. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't work the steps. And I knew all about the steps. And I had read them and said, yeah, done that one. Got that one. Check them off. I've done those. And I guess, like I said, about 9 months into the program, everybody was all abuzz. We were going to have our first women's retreat. It was going to be on the lake. And Vinoy S. was coming from California at that time to lead it. She did a step study right out of the big book. And she was awesome. And at her very first break, I ran to that beautiful little white-haired, blue-eyed, angelic woman and asked her to be my sponsor. And I found out she wasn't that angelic after all. She was truly a black belt Al-Anon. And we got to work on those steps. We started immediately. She said, you know, honey, she says, first you got to identify your disease, and your disease is control. And I said, not me. He's always in control. And then she had me look at the ways that I had tried to manipulate and control, and I had to look at that. And the second step just teed me off. Insanity, and then she reminded me, going out of windows and, you know, all this stuff I've been telling you, that was not exactly actions of a sane woman. So she said that if I wanted to be the, ever wanted to be the woman that God created me to be, I had to admit to the woman that I was. And I could do that, and I could start working my steps. And I did. And it started to change little by little. My men's steps, the first amends I did was to my parents. I knew that they did love me in their own way unconditionally. And by that time, my mother had developed Alzheimer's. And I could be there to help Daddy. In fact, I'm this button person. One of my other little buttons said, coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. And I find that's true all through my life if I just look for those coincidences and find God in them. And I was on my way home from work and just decided on the spur of the moment to stop by my dad's. And he was in there putting the very first diaper on my mom. And he was crying and struggling and crying. And I could be there to help him put that diaper on her. And take just a little bit of that off of his shoulders. And when we moved to Texas some years later, my mother had died, and we moved my daddy over there so we could be near him and help take care of him. And when he died, Ray and I were there holding his hand and singing his favorite hymns to him. And because of Al-Anon, there was nothing left unsaid between us. Because, see, I had started hugging them and telling them I loved them. I was the first to do it, but when I did, they started to respond, and I got what I needed after all. The amends to Ray were pretty easy. You know, we just started doing better, you know, treating each other, giving each other 100% to our marriage. And I had to look at my part. You know, in Al-Anon, you know, we'd say we didn't cause it, we can't cure it, we can't control it, but there's another C for me. I can contribute, and I did contribute an awful lot. I tried to set up scenarios that would prove that Ray loved me, because somehow I could not get it in my head that he loved me, that who could love me, because I was so unlovable. And I know he just loved those romantic holidays. I'm telling you, especially Valentine's Day and birthdays, Lord, and anniversaries. And this one particular anniversary I'm going to tell you about, I guess I've been in Al-Anon a couple of years, and I wasn't perfect yet, still not. So anyway, it was our anniversary, and I was getting ready for it. I bought elaborate gifts for him. I had a beautiful dinner for him. Didn't say a word to him about it, of course. Well, when he came home and he saw it, Lord, he was like a deer in the headlights. Poor thing, he didn't know what was going on. And that night when we went to bed, I laid in bed and I sniveled and I sniffed and I flounced and I sniveled. And finally he said, what is wrong with you? And I said, well, if you don't know, I'm not telling you. So I got up and I went and slept in the other bed. And that morning, I had to get up and go to work. I had an appointment earlier than him. And so I opened my little ODAT book, One Day at a Time. This is probably the first reader that Al-Anon had, and it was the only one at the time. And our anniversary is July 8th. So this was July 9th. And I opened it up, and I'm not going to read the whole page. I'm just going to read what I had highlighted in here. It says, "What kind of stuff is self-pity made of that it can entrench itself in my mind and keep me miserable? Self-pity comes from concentrating on the negative aspects of life. I will work toward a more mature attitude and settle for a little less than my romantic dreams make me think I ought to have." Wow. How do they do that? I mean, seriously, every time that I've had a problem and grab my book, I mean, God or somebody messes the pages up. It's always right on time. But Ray and I just are here for each other. He's my biggest cheerleader, and we try to work our own programs separately, and yet we share a lot of program together. Our minister, our children. Our older son was always one of these in-your-face kids. He talked about it. If he felt it, you knew it, he said it. In fact, when he was a teenager, he'd tell me stuff I really didn't want to know. So when we talked to him about it, he would talk back, and we discussed, and we felt like that we had made our amends properly. And then when we went to our younger son, it was like, "I don't know what you're talking about. I must have not been there. I don't remember any of that." He was in total denial, and really there was nothing more we could do except living amends. And my sponsor told me, once you've made your amends, you don't keep crawling back and begging for forgiveness. You've made your amends, and you just go on, and you just act like the person that God wants you to be. And so we left it at that. The spiritual awakening. Oh my gosh, I want a spiritual awakening like Ray so bad. I wanted that burning bush so bad. It didn't happen that way for me. I guess my spiritual awakening happened one night I told my story to our group. We had a monthly potluck supper and speaker meeting, and it was my turn to tell my story. I don't know how long I've been in the program, not very long. On the way back home, Ray was driving, and I remember this overwhelming feeling of okayness just flooded my body and my soul. And I felt like I was just so okay right then, that I was so loved, that I was wrapped in love, and that who I was, what I looked like, and that was my big thing. Where I was, who I was with, what I was doing, just everything right that moment were so totally okay. I was okay with myself. And I realized that was my spiritual awakening. And I realized also that it didn't happen that night, but that was my first awareness, but it had been a process that had been happening to me during the process of working my steps. You know, the last part of that step says we practice these principles in all our affairs. Ray and I got back into church after a few years. We'd been out for a while, and when I got back, it seemed to be different. When I left, they were preaching hellfire and damnation. And when I got back, they were preaching the 12 steps. At least that's what I heard. We had one preacher, and I would tell him what step he preached on every Sunday. I know he loved that. We also started going to the prisons on our motorcycles. Oh, we are biker trash. I'll get that out of the way. We ride our motorcycles into the prison, and we carry the message of God's love and healing to the inmates. And, before Al-Anon, you could just lock the door and throw away the key. But, after God left me out of my head, I had to tell other people. Most of the people in prison we have found, probably 85%, are locked up directly or indirectly because of drugs and alcohol. And we would go down through the rows, and Ray would show his little medallion, and that just broke the ice, and we could start talking to them. We get such joy out of that. And we ride our motorcycles to the church under the bridge in Austin and minister to the homeless. And I guess my greatest joy in giving away. It's been in sponsorship. It is such a joy holding hands with another woman and helping her become the woman that God created her to be, to see her bloom and blossom and smile again. It's just such a joy for me. I can't think of anything better than that. And also, that's one of the ways I make indirect amends to my children. I try to help young women not make the same mistakes that I made with my children and become the mother that they need to be to their children. Our older son had moved to New England a few years earlier, and he was a high-tech executive, and he put together a big merger and was able to retire at the age of 38, and he moved to Austin and started wanting us to come and move and be near him and be there for his grandchildren. And we finally decided to go, and he made that possible. And most of our non-program friends could not understand how we could go someplace where we didn't know another soul, because you see, we didn't move to Austin, we moved to Fredericksburg. But we knew that you'd be there. Different faces, same love. And so we did. And Fredericksburg is just close enough to Austin that we can drive over for our big, good-looking grandson's football games or our beautiful little granddaughter's dance recitals. But not close enough that we know everything's going on in their lives, and I don't need to know everything's going on in their lives, because, see, I'm still not well, and I just might be tempted to get in the middle of it. And I don't need to do it. And I don't ask a lot of questions, because I don't want to make somebody lie to me. And they are adults, that it really is none of my business, no matter if it hurts me. Not long after we had moved to Texas, this van backed up in our driveway and unloaded another 57 T-Bird convertible. It was a surprise gift from our older son. And we couldn't believe it. Beautiful white thing with baby blue top and a navy blue rag top and baby blue interior, just gorgeous. And when Ray called him to ask him, why in the world did you do that? And he said, well, Daddy, he said, you know, I used to ask you, why'd you get rid of that T-Bird? And he said, you'd say, well, I couldn't afford it and your mom too. You know, gas was 24 cents a gallon back then. And he said, Daddy, if you'd chosen the other way, I wouldn't be in this world. So I owe you that T-Bird. So we've been like kids with a new toy. We joined a touring club. We've just been all over the place in that thing. And we joined every club that would have us. And we've just had a blast living. And it's the heart of the Texas Hill Country. We'd been there in 1997 for the National BMW Motorcycle Rally and fell in love with the wildflowers then. And but we never thought we'd make it back. And we did. We moved in 2000. And just love it. It's a biker's paradise. A lot of retired people, always somewhere to go and something to do. A lot of festivals. They celebrate everything. Parade for everything. And life has been good. But, you know, even in recovery, things do happen. And both of our sons developed addictions later in life. They were both had children and careers before they really developed and flourished. Because, see, they were like their daddy. They were a workaholic for a long time. And our younger son, John, had moved to Charleston, South Carolina some years before, as I said, and married this girl there, and he had two little boys. Those two little boys just were over here visiting us just yesterday and the day before. We came early so they could drive up from Charleston and be with us, and we've had a blast with them, but they've gone home now. They're 13 and 10 now. But our son started drinking wine. I knew he was drinking some wine, and he used to say, well, it was for the pain. He said, it's better than taking a pain pill. I remember that. You see, he had been an athlete and a bodybuilder, and his shoulder would just fall out of joint, just for nothing, not even lifting weights. It'd just fall out of joint. And he finally gave in and had some real painful surgery and painful physical therapy. He had quit his job and decided he was being called into the ministry and went to seminary at Wake Forest and started a new church. It was for people like us, the bruised and the battered and the broken, and that's the people he wanted. And he was a big, charismatic, good-looking young man. People were drawn to him. People would say, you're just not like a regular preacher. They just loved him. He was just right. He went right into their life without making them change to come into his. And but he started drinking the wine for the pain, and then, of course, we were not living close near them. We'd see them a few times a year, but not knowing everything that was going on in their lives. And then he developed an addiction, and he had crossed that line, and he went to treatment. Actually, he went to outpatient treatment, and one day my daughter-in-law called me, and I got the most horrible news I'd ever heard in my life. She told me that John was addicted to heroin. I cannot tell you, it was like somebody just slapped me in the gut. Because you see, here again is my judgment, my self-righteousness. I'll have to admit, I've been in the program a long time, but I still have this hidden judgmentalness about addicts. You know, that's until it hit my home. Because you see, any of us can be people like that. We can all be people like that. And he went to 30-day treatment, but he could never really get sober. And his addiction to heroin, apparently, according to the doctors, was progressed so fast. And he tried drinking beer. He told me he was just drinking beer, and I'd try to talk to him, but you know, they never listened to the parents. And they told me when I got in the program, you can help another person's child, but you can't help your child. And that's why we found it. And because, you know, we could make him mad at us. That's about the best we could do. So we had to just leave it to God, give it to God, and pray that somebody would come and help him. And he did try AA a few times, and he developed a resentment at somebody in the program, and he quit AA. You know, and I knew what the big book said about alcoholics and resentments. And on May 18th of 2007, it was a very special day in our lives. Ray and I were riding our motorcycles about 5 hours north of our house to a spiritual retreat. The special day was it was Ray's 17th AA birthday. And just a real special day. And we got there, and we went over and registered at the campground and came back to our little cabin on the Brazos. And there was a note from my older son. John was dead of an overdose of heroin. I know those of you who have lost children know. And you'd think I could finally get up here and say this without breaking down, but somehow it's just still too fresh. But anyway, we were there that night, and we had no phone. We had to use the phone at the people at the house that had the campground. And so that was a horrible night. We couldn't drive back. It was dark by then, and we were in no shape and couldn't call anybody. It's a miserable, miserable night. But we spent the night just trying to read. I've learned that reading can be the most wonderful gift that I can get, because Ray'd say, just, honey, read a word, then try to read a sentence, then try to read a paragraph. And one of the biggest gifts I've been given in the program is find that I can control what I think about. You know, I can't think about two things at the same time. And I can let a horrible negative thought get in my mind, and I can massage it and let it just fly. Or I can stop it before it gets entrenched in my mind and try to think of something else or do something else that will take its place. And that's what I had to do all that night. But we flew to Charleston with our other son and his family and went through the funeral. And John had told us that he didn't have a friend in the world when we'd been there in the January before. And there were hundreds and hundreds of people there, and every one of them telling us of the things that John had done in their lives, how he had helped them grow closer to God, how he had baptized their children and their whole families, how he'd even buried their dog when they couldn't. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. But, you know, we would talk on the phone before he died, and he would tell me how miserable and depressed he was, and it just, my guts would twist out because there's nothing I could do for him. And we had a long talk on Mother's Day, and he died the next Friday, and it was a special talk. And he told me something that has just been a gift to me. He told me that he had been to church the night before, and that they were singing some old hymn that talked about God's love, God's amazing love. And he said suddenly, for the very first time, he realized that God loved him no matter what he had done, that God loved him. And he said, you know, Mother, I've been preaching that God loves you and you and you, but I never really believed he loved me. And you know, I could understand that, because that was me most of my life. I never could really believe that God could love me. And so that's been a a blessing to me to know that. John was an awesome dad, and I know you understand that. A lot of people out there don't understand that you could be a heroin addict and an awesome dad, but he dearly loved his children. But you know, he lost the power of choice. And we flew back home, and about 3 weeks later, we got a call. Our older son's church had had a memorial service for John. And he came home, and he took a Valium, and he drank wine with his wife, and he went into his first blackout. He did some horrible, violent things. And he was arrested. He was in jail for several days. He was charged with a felony. He was in bad trouble. I thought, what more could happen? He did get out and go to a 30-day treatment center and seemed to be doing beautifully and going to AA and got a sponsor. Said he was working the steps, you know, but I don't know. They live away, and I don't get into their lives. And we thought, though, that most everything was going okay. And I guess about all this time, Ray is dealing with chest pain. We'd been in and out of hospitals, and nobody could ever diagnose him. He passed all the tests for heart. And during this time, also his stepfather that died that had raised him. We'd been back and forth all over with that, and Ray with chest pains. I can't tell you the many trips with EMS to the hospital, no diagnosis. And then we got the call that Brian had gone into another blackout. You see, his wife was even drinking wine with him because she couldn't believe that he was really an alcoholic. He had been into a treatment center in Houston some years before, and they said he was just depressive. He was not alcoholic. Because, see, he can change addiction so easily. He can take alcohol, or he can take drugs, or he can get on the Internet and buy everything till his heart's content. But it's never content. There's never enough for him. He went into bicycle racing. He went so far as to hire Lance Armstrong's coach for himself and raced in the Tour de France. And he trained so hard that he lost all the chemicals in his body, and he was near death. And so everything he does is to extreme. And but he did. They drank, and he went into another blackout, and he was arrested again. And this time his attorney told him he better get to a long-term treatment center in Atlanta, and he did. Exactly 6 months to the day after our son died, Ray was airlifted to Austin Heart Hospital near death with triple blockages of 99% each. And he had surgery on Sunday because it was such an emergency. And our son got a pass to get out of treatment, and he came for the surgery. And Ray survived, and I guess God's not through with him yet. He's still here. And but you know, I never thought we could have ever made it through all of those things. Our son has been out of the treatment center now for probably a year and a half, and his lawyer did a good job, and so he doesn't have a felony anymore. And I was going to say he's lucky, but maybe he's not lucky. You know, I don't know. I've met so many people in prison that said that's the best thing that ever happened to them. So maybe it wasn't a blessing that he got off. I don't know. But he had the money to be able to do so, and it happened. And he seems to be doing well. He seems to be doing really good. And our life, it's been good. You know, we're getting back on our feet. The grief was so tough and so hard. And I had to finally get to a point of acceptance. You know, when I accept something, that doesn't mean I agree with it. It just means that I have no power over it. And that acceptance almost always leads to surrender, because I have to surrender to God. Because of myself, I can't do it. Because my grief took me so many places that I never want to go again. My grief convinced me that I would always feel this way and I'd never get over it. And that was my biggest fear. But my acceptance and my surrender led me to gratitude. And I finally came to the place where I was grateful. I was grateful that John was no longer miserable and depressed. You know, he was at peace. I didn't have to worry that he was going to hurt his children or his wife or somebody else. You know, God in his mercy let him come home. Our older son seems to be doing well, and I don't know. And if I get into the fear of the future, as they say, the wreckage of the future, I can just make myself miserable. And I've got to know that God gives me grace each day, just one day at a time. The reason I get fearful about tomorrow, I don't have that grace yet, but it'll come. That grace always comes when I'm ready for it and when I'm there and when I'm open and when I hang around winners like you. You know, if I had one word to describe Al-Anon, it would be freedom, the gift of freedom. Freedom from resentment and fears and negative emotions, but mostly freedom from me. I am no longer in bondage to myself. You know, my mess has become my message. You know, every single pain and bad thing that's happened to me, God has given me the opportunity to share it with someone else when they need it, just when they need it. And just recently, I got a new sponsee that came in the program, and we had just done her third step, and she called me one night, and she said she got that call no mother wants to get. Her son was killed in a car wreck, and one more time, I knew that I had an experience I could share. And that's the way Al-Anon works, you know, one Al-Anon talking to another, telling how we've been helped. You know, Al-Anon has truly become God's amazing grace for insecure, fearful, crazy woman like me. And I got to tell you that I love you and God loves you. And that old hole inside was always God-shaped. And he loves you and I love you. And there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. Thank you for being here for me today.
Wonderful, wasn't she? We thank you for coming and sharing. And we want you to hear from the convention. Yeah.
Looks like that chocolate cake we had the other night for me.
Never know.
My mother used to always be so slow at Christmas. She'd get so aggravated. Everybody would be through and she'd still be. Okay. I've been seeing it, but I didn't know what they said. So I don't know. The Serenity Prayer, Fellowship by the Sea 2009, my name. Thank you.
Let us get down there with y'all and we'll end with the Lord's Prayer.